From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today we'll tell you about a Milwaukee building that has columns made up of ancient sea fossils.
Wherever you touch, you'll be touching ancient life, basically. It's about the most fossiliferous or fossil-rich stone you can find in Milwaukee, or anywhere else in America for that matter.
Then our astronomy contributor will share what areas of the tropics make it such a great place for stargazing and a change in perspective.
I've had students who come from different parts of the world and they see how the crescent moon is shown and they think that's wrong. They're used to seeing the moon as a U when it sets.
Plus, we'll hear new local music in the Milwaukee Music Roundup. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. On a triangular lot at the intersection of Center Street and Fond du Lac Avenue stands the Kilbourne State Bank Building, sometimes referred to as the North Milwaukee State Bank Building or simply the Poster Building. This building was once the home of Wisconsin's first black-owned bank, according to the Wisconsin Historical Society. And its columns contain fossils that are over 300 million years old. Raymond Wiggers is a geologist and author of Milwaukee in Stone and Clay. He joins Lake Effect's Sam Woods to discuss the architectural geology of the Kilbourne State Bank building for the latest episode of What Milwaukee is Made Of.
Let's talk about the building materials at this bank, starting with the main entrance's imposing columns. When and where did these columns originate?
Well, as you mentioned, the bank is a fairly small building on an unusual triangular lot, which makes it resemble in a small way Milwaukee City Hall. But the building is made up of brick. We'll talk about that later. But the columns and also a lot of the trim and the lintels and the other portions of the building in the front are crafted of a very, very popular, very widely used American building stone called the Salem limestone. And if you are an architect or a builder, you don't know it as the Salem. That's the geological name for it. It's actually referred to as either the Bedford Stone. It's quarried in places like Bedford, southern Indiana, or just Indiana limestone. And wherever you go in Milwaukee, you'll find it somewhere in your neighborhood because it's so prevalent. And it actually dates to a period of geologic time known as the Carboniferous period, and specifically the earlier part of the Carboniferous known as the Mississippian subperiod. And that is roughly 340 million years ago.
What was the Earth like at this time?
Well, in the Mississippian, what was happening was a number of the large land masses of the world were coming together into the supercontinent we all know and love as Pangaea. And Pangaea really assembled completely a little bit later. But at this point, the Midwest, including both southern Indiana, where that stone was formed, and also the Milwaukee area, was pretty close to the equator, not exactly on the equator, but close. And so the climate was probably tropical. And in that time, large portions of the Midwest, especially southern Indiana, were actually covered by a shallow sea that actually covered part of what we now call North America, because it was a time of global warming. It was a time when sea level was very high.
You mentioned this stone originated likely underneath a shallow sea. Do we see any evidence of sea life in this rock?
Boy, do we. That's all it is, basically. In fact, sometimes it's referred to as fossil hash, you know, as in corned beef hash or whatever, because it's made up of tiny little fragments of broken up seashells, basically, or shells of marine creatures that were living in the Mississippian subperiod. Things like trilobites and crinoids and brachiopods and other sea creatures that were living in shallow water not far from the shoreline. There was some dry land around farther north. And these creatures lived in tidal inlets. They lived in lagoons and other shallow areas where the water, it was what geologists call a high energy environment, where you have water sweeping in and out every day in accordance with the tides. And so as these creatures died, their shells got broken up and deposited in these large deposits that were later glued together with a mineral called calcite.
So just to be clear, like if I put my hand on one of these columns, then I'm touching fossils of creatures that were living over 300 million years ago, almost certainly.
Absolutely, certainly. Yeah, wherever you touch, you'll be touching ancient life, basically. It's about the most fossiliferous or fossil-rich stone you can find in Milwaukee or anywhere else in America, for that matter. And one of the reasons that it's actually so workable and such a highly regarded stone, it cuts very easily, it carves very easily, is that it has this kind of granular texture that is made up of these tiny little fossils. But if you look really carefully, if you take a little hand lens or some kind of hand magnifier and go right up to the stone, you can actually sometimes see entire fossils. And there are also, you know, microscopic foram fossils that you'll see that are completely entire. But most of the stuff you're looking at that's glued together is actually broken up shell.
And how does this stone hold up over time?
Well, to answer that, you have to consider where the stone is actually used. It's like a lot of other building stones. It depends where it is and what it comes into contact with. When the stone was completely new, when the Salem limestone was first marketed broadly in the late 1800s, people assumed, architects assumed that it was just about indestructible. But as time went on, it became clear that it actually has an Achilles heel. If you place the limestone right in contact with the ground, right in the front of the building, for example, right next to a sidewalk, especially in a climate like Milwaukee's, where in the winter, you have people throwing down salt and then the snow or the ice melts. What will happen is the stone will actually wick up or suck that toxic brew of salt water into the stone itself. And to make a long story short, it will break down the stone. And if you're standing in front of the Kilbourne State Bank, you will notice at the base of the columns that we were just talking about, there are places where the stone looks like it's been eaten away. Almost like it's been eaten away by termites or something. But actually, that's just its contact with the groundwater.
So expanding outward from the main entrance, it looks like most of this building is made from brick. And it looks like a type of brick we've seen elsewhere in the city. What is that?
That's a very good question. In fact, when we first started talking about featuring this building, when we took good pictures of the building, we realized that what this was a brick that's almost or totally identical to brick that's used elsewhere in Milwaukee on very famous buildings like the Pabst Theater and also a building right next to the Pabst Theater, which is very architecturally distinguished, called the Oneida Street Station, an old power station. And the brick there is a kind of a ochre or a light tan color. But if you get close to it, it has these little dark red or maroon flecks all the way through it. And that was a characteristic brick that was made in St. Louis. St. Louis, Missouri was a great brick making center for many, many years. And this was one of its premium facing bricks. So at Kilbourne Bank, we don't know for sure that that's St. Louis brick. At least I haven't found any records that confirm that, but it's a dead ringer for it. So if I were forced to guess, I would say this is probably a St. Louis brick.
So this building is on a triangular lot, which is not unusual in Milwaukee, particularly on diagonal streets like Fond du Lac Avenue. But is there anything about the architectural style that stands out to you?
I think the architect had to adapt to that unusual triangular shape. You're right that it's quite common in Milwaukee, but it still is a challenge for any architect to come up with a building that has, well, essentially four sides still, but those sides have different relations to each other than in a regular rectangular building. The thing that I find so interesting about the Kilbourne Bank, first of all, it was built originally in 1905. And it was in a completely different architectural style than you see today. It was in a style known as the Queen Anne style. And Queen Anne was very, very, the style was very, very common in the late 19th century. And it generally featured a kind of a whimsical combination of earlier styles with towers and balconies and all sorts of interesting things, often rather asymmetrical, rather offset look to the thing. A lot of Milwaukee's great stately homes are in the Queen Anne style from the 19th century. But then in 1928, the same architect, Henry André, actually came back and he redesigned it for the new management, Kilbourne State Bank. And it was turned into a neoclassical or classical revival or Beaux-Arts style, which had become very, very popular, especially for community and city banks in the early 1900s. And this had a much more formal, classical or Roman architectural look to it.
Was there a reason that that formal, classical, Roman look was desirable in 1928, but not in 1905?
Well, first of all, the Beaux-Arts style was very popular in general for large government buildings, for smaller buildings, for banks, for all sorts of commercial buildings, starting in the latest, like the 1890s, getting into the early 20th century. But for banks especially, it was favored. It was a rather conservative style. It tended to imply, if you look at the bank building, it tended to imply that it was a temple of commerce or a temple of capitalism, and it was very secure and very stable. It's a very stable-looking architectural style.
So other than architectural style, what do we know about the human history of this building?
Well, for most of its history, up until recent decades, it definitely was a bank. It was a neighborhood bank. And it was originally, we tend to go by, in both architectural historian circles, and also if you're an architectural geologist, you tend to use the original name of the building when you're talking about it. But that original name, the Kilbourne State Bank, was only really pertinent until 1971, from 1928 to 71. And then in 1971, for that decade, it was the North Milwaukee State Bank. And as you mentioned before, our records indicate anyway that this was the first African-American owned bank, not only in Milwaukee, but in Wisconsin.
Well, Ray, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
It's been great. Thanks again, Sam.
That was Raymond Wiggers, author of Milwaukee in Stone and Clay, a book about the architectural geology of Milwaukee buildings. He spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods for our series, What Milwaukee is Made Of. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll head to the tropics with our astronomy contributor, Gene Creighton. But first, have you lost something precious, or are you curious if there might be something valuable hidden on your property? Well then, you'll want to hear our next conversation with a metal detectorist. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Don't talk of love. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Have you ever wondered what might be hidden underground? Well, a metal detectorist can help with that. Bruce Retkowski is a metal detectorist who travels the state finding homeowners who want their old property searched for historical objects. Lake Effect's Ex-Grit Nunez spoke with Retkowski about his love for metal detecting and what makes Milwaukee a special place to search.
I'm curious, what got you interested in metal detecting and what keeps you going?
My brother-in-law, Tom, and his wife have a property up around Mauston area, and there's a lake up there called Castle Rock Lake that has an island in it. And they take their boat out there, and around that island, there is a lot of sand. So people take and they park their boats, and they wade through the water, and they have parties, and they lose their stuff. And he was a detectorist at the time, and he said, come on, we're going to try this. So, you know, he showed me how to do things and found some interesting items around that island because that island used to be a farmland. They created that lake by damming the Wisconsin River. One of the things that he found, which had nothing to do with metal, in his scoop one time, he brought up a bison tooth. Bison haven't been in Wisconsin for many, many years, and he got that verified by a UWM scientist.
And so how long have you been doing this for? Like, what year was that when you started?
It's about 10 years. Started out slow, and my wife said, I think I'm going to get you a metal detector for your birthday. And So I got a beginner metal detector, and it's been forward since then.
What a gift.
Yes, I was very happy to receive that.
And so I noticed, too, that you go by the Bruce.
Yes.
Why do you call yourself the Bruce?
That moniker was given to me by another detectorist, Rob Rizzo, who's known as the History Digger. Him and his wife said, oh, you know, Rob, you're the History Digger. We got to give Bruce a name. And there is a character in Braveheart that goes by the name of the Bruce. He's a duke or something like that. And he said, that's what we're going to call you. We're going to call you the Bruce. And then he found a statue face or a bust of the Bruce. And it, you know, somewhat looks like me, which was really odd. But that's how I got that name.
I love it. And is that a thing in the metal detectorist communities to have nicknames or monikers?
I would say yes, because there's a bunch of guys who put together videos and they post them on YouTube, and they all have their title. You know, one is the Quarter Hoarder. There's the Hoover Boys. There's, you know, just many detectorists who they have pet names.
No, that's really interesting. And so I'm curious, you've been doing this for 10 years now. Is there a certain item that really sparked your interest in metal detecting and wonder what else is underground?
Oh my gosh, there's so many items. The big item that people always want to find is gold. And I found three gold items. I found two gold rings and a gold necklace that has a silver cross on it. My friend in the Milwaukee area found a $5 gold piece, which dates back to the mid-1800s, I believe, and that's the prize. That's, you know, you always want to find the gold, the hidden treasure. Another friend went over to England and he found a gold coin that dates back to, I believe, the 1500s. So there's always the gold to find, but most of the stuff you pull out is trash, junk, you know, pop tops, cans, nails, and things like that. But you're always looking for that silver coin or the, you know, the gold ring or the silver ring. Or if you're on an older property, just something to relate to that property that you can give to that owner and say, well, this looks like a handle from your door or something like that.
And so what do you, okay, say you find a gold ring, you're not really in it for the money, are you? Or are you more in for the history of it?
I'm definitely not in for the money. The story I like to tell is that somebody emailed me about losing her mom's gold wedding band. Her mom had passed away when she was 7, and her dad gave her the mom's wedding band. And she said, I was at a family reunion. You know, I lost it. We tried to find it. You know, I'm out here in California. I was at a family reunion in West Bend. Could you try to find it? And I told her, well, I've never found anything intentionally, but I will, you know, I'll recruit a couple guys. You know, do you have any idea where in the yard it might have been lost? She sent me an overhead picture, and she drew where most of the people were gathering. We got there, and I had two guys with me, and my friend found it in 20 minutes. Wow. So she got her mom's wedding band back, and she was overjoyed. You know, she said, what can I give you guys? What can I give you guys? We told her, you know, we don't want anything. Your happiness that the ring has been found and returned to you is more than enough for us.
So these items have a lot of sentimental value as well as historical value.
Yes. If we find something on a property that, like you said, is sentimental, we always show it to the property owner and we say, you know, you can decide if you want to keep it or not. If it doesn't belong to them, they can still keep it, or they can, you know, let us have, you know, what we have found. And that happens sometimes. And that's, you know, that's just part of our mantra. You know, we always say, it's found on your property. I'm willing to give it to you. It was the joy of finding it. If we get to keep it, it's bonus for us.
I love that. And so I want to talk about the fact that you recently made a few posts on Facebook asking homeowners if you can metal detect their property. I'm wondering why you would metal detect on a private property instead of sticking to public places like Milwaukee's beaches.
The beaches have been hit hard by other detectorists. During the months of October through April, nobody's on the beach. Nobody's losing their stuff on the beach. Then through from May till September, those beaches are populated and people might lose their rings or their bracelets or their change. And then there are a lot of people who, a lot of detectorists who go there after those weekends, and they can be kind of territorial sometimes, you know, saying, oh, this is my beach, you know, why are you here? I don't tend to go to beaches very often in Milwaukee. I like to go to private properties, you know, places that other people haven't been to. You always ask for permission. There is never a time when I just go randomly on somebody's in somebody's yard. That would be trespassing. That's illegal. That breaks the code of a detectorist. So that's why I put out those letters, posts on Facebook looking for those permissions.
And do rules around metal detecting vary across the places that you visit?
Yes. There are some communities where they don't want detectorists in their parks. Milwaukee, sometimes they've been cracked down, the detectorists have been cracked down on saying, you know, you can't dig here. And that's basically because some detectorists aren't very polite. They don't refill their holes. They leave damage in the parks. You know, we try to refill and flatten down the ground as much as possible so that nobody knows we're there. Different counties have different regulations in their parks where you have to have a permit. Sometimes the permit is just free, where they just want to know that you know the rules. Some counties say, no, we don't want you there at all.
Are there rules of who gets what when it comes to finding things on public and private land?
Public land is a free-for-all, basically. I mean, you find it, it's yours, unless, you know, unless it's got some marking on it that you can return it to somebody. Class rings, sometimes people can trace back to other people. There is a small group of detectorists who are called ring finders. So somebody will put a post out and say, I lost my ring so-and-so here and here. And those guys will, guys or gals, I should say, will go out and, you know, try to find it for them. Private land, always try to show what we find to the homeowners. Like this morning, I was out at a property in Wauwatosa, and it was a more modern property, mid-50s house. Didn't find a lot, found like 27 cents in change. There was a very small running medal, like from a high school, that I found, and I left with that homeowner. He said, oh, my daughter will be overjoyed to see what you found in the yard. So that stayed with that homeowner. It didn't belong to him, you know, personally, but it's part of their land. You know, that house has been around for 75 years. Who knows who that belonged to?
That's so neat, though.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So in general, I mean, you're kind of speaking to it, other than being basically untapped territory. Is there something special about metal detecting the yards of homes in Milwaukee?
I love the old homes. Milwaukee has great history. Wisconsin was established in 1848. Wisconsin has great ethnic history, especially Milwaukee. You know, so those old houses where, like, downtown Milwaukee just grew outward. You know, and you had those neighborhoods where people congregated in their ethnic groups, you know, the Irish, the German, the Poles. They had their stuff. They had their things. And sometimes we find those things when we go to these yards, and we can relate it to those houses or to those people. And that's the history that we enjoy really finding. Basically, we're modern-day time travelers. What was happening when this 1848 coin was made? Who held it? How did it get dropped? You know, you can think of all kinds of stories to make up about it, but you just really don't know. You just know that it's there and I found it.
You're the first metal detectorist I've ever met.
Okay.
Is there a metal detecting community in the Milwaukee area?
There is. In fact, we just had a meeting this past Tuesday. We meet once a month at a little restaurant in Cudahy. There are detecting clubs all through Wisconsin.
How many people would you say are in, like, the Milwaukee area metal detectorist club?
I would say there's probably 50 to 60. There has been a growing number of people showing up at this meeting, which is nice and surprising. It was typically a year ago we'd get maybe 8 guys.
So we've talked about how the thing that you most enjoy about metal detecting is discovering the history of the items you find. What are some of the most interesting items you found?
I found a medallion at a park in Milwaukee that dates back to the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. It was the Columbian World Expo Fair, which commemorated Columbus discovering America. And how did it end up in Milwaukee? It happened in 1893. So that's a memorable one for me. I really enjoyed that one. There's a book that goes along with that. My oldest coin that I've ever found is an 1842 Canadian penny minted in, it's called from the Bank of Montreal. It's called a bank token. It wasn't a, I don't know if they minted different coins from different areas in Canada, but that's my oldest coin find.
And where did you find that one?
That was at a farm in Kenosha.
Well, for people who might be interested in having you search their yards, where can they reach you?
They can send me an email at thebruce1959@gmail.com.
Bruce, thanks so much for speaking with me today. I'm super excited to get out there with you. And
I brought a detector that I'm going to have you try also.
You're going to have me try one?
Sure, why not?
Oh my God, I'm so excited. Okay, this changes the game. Okay, I'm so excited. Thanks. Well, I'm. Thank you for talking to me.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. This is just setting it up for the use of it.
So, would you be okay with recording me?
Yes.
Okay.
Because you want it out in front of you.
Okay.
You know, so like you can still be standing up straight, but you want to be able to extend your arm a bit.
Okay, that's it? Is this good?
Yes.
Okay.
Try to keep the coil low to the ground.
Okay, like that?
Yep. And swing. You have to, it should be swung all the time.
Am I going?
You're going fine.
Okay.
That sounds like a bottle top or a tin can. Mm.
Or a gold ring. No. Oh. We'll keep going.
Well, I think we should check that one out. Let me get the shovel.
Okay.
Okay, swing the detector back and forth. See how it ends when you pull back?
Yeah. So right there.
Yeah. I gotta dig a three-sided plug.
Digging the plug. I'll go this way.
Okay. Alright. And you try to visually see this. Do you visually see anything?
Rocks.
Yep, rocks and soil. Now you're gonna use that pinpointer and put it down in the hole, see if it...
So you're very close to it, whatever it might be. It's gonna be in the sidewall, like behind where you had that pinpointer. I'm gonna give you the little shovel.
Okay. Oh, it's a nail.
Blasted nails.
So why was it so high?
It was a good signal. It's just a mix.
Just a mix.
Yep.
Oh. Bummer. I was ready for the ring.
I thought that was gonna be a dime or a quarter.
Okay. Well, put this in your pouch.
Standard screw. Fill it with your hand and stomp your foot on it. So it looks like it's even with the rest of the soil, and that's...
Is that okay?
Yep.
Well, that was fun. Can I do one more?
Oh, yep.
Okay.
Bruce Ratkowski is a metal detectorist in the Milwaukee area known as The Bruce. He spoke with Lake Effects expert Nunez and invited her to try out some metal detecting. You just heard them searching at a Bayview home built in 1890. While we're certainly not experiencing tropical weather here in Wisconsin this spring, you can visit the tropics at UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium. Their April show, Stars in the Tropics, takes stargazers to different cities near the equator to explore different night skies and astronomical monuments. Planetarium director and Lake Effect astronomy contributor Jean Creighton joins me now to share more. She starts by explaining what it means to actually be in the tropics, and what makes it a great spot for astronomy.
Of the whole band of people who live in the tropics, there's plenty of people who get rain, who actually don't have, lots of humidity, not so great for astronomy. But we have chosen places that are particularly dry and suitable and also have at least one astronomical connection. And we probably won't have time to go through all of them here and now, but people can come in and see for themselves. So, shall we talk a little bit about how we define the tropics?
Yeah, let's do that. And you mentioned a little bit about conditions, but yeah, how are these conditions at these places you've selected different from what we have here?
Okay, so let's first of all ask ourselves, is Milwaukee in the tropics?
Definitely
It is not.
not.
And the reason, from an astronomical point of view, we know is that there is no day in the year where the sun is directly overhead. That's the definition. To be in the tropics, you need to have at least one day where you have the sun directly overhead. It turns out that, therefore, the band is defined by two tropics, the Tropic of Cancer, that will have one day a year, and that will be on the summer solstice, which for the Northern Hemisphere is going to be in June. And on the southern side, it's going to be the Tropic of Capricorn, and that's going to be when the sun is directly overhead on their summer solstice, which is in December. The areas between those are going to be in the tropics. So in the US, we only have two places that are technically in the tropics. Hawaii would be one, and Puerto Rico would be the other. Every other part of the US is north of the tropics.
So, are we going to visit Hawaii and Puerto Rico via the Manfred Olson Planetarium? Any
We
hints
are
of.
not, as it turns out. We could, but we are going to go to more exotic locations. So we're going to start in Chile. Now, most of Chile is outside of the tropics, but there's a little bit of it on the top that is in the tropics. And we chose Chile because, of course, it has so many wonderful telescopes. We are in a desert, a high desert, and they're opposite seasons of ours. So they're in that sweet spot in early fall, which is so beautiful.
And I imagine with these changes in location, especially globally, that you're able to see some constellations that normally we don't have in our night sky here in Wisconsin, or at least not all the time.
Or indeed ever. So if when I went to, I've only been to Chile once, a friend of mine, we were graduate students together. She lives now in Chile, and she was arguing that the sky is better in the southern hemisphere. We couldn't really get into an argument about this because we all have our own opinions about what we're familiar with. But what's true is that the center of our galaxy is higher at that latitude, and therefore, what's interesting to me was that constellations are envisioned completely different. So rather than having some form of connect the dot that what you're seeing, the pattern that you're seeing, is determined by the stars. In the southern hemisphere, and this is true both in Chile and in Australia, where we're going to go next, is that the patterns are the negative space, so what we call the dust lanes in the Milky Way. So along the Milky Way, there are areas where there's a lot of dust, and that blocks light that comes from stars behind those dust lanes. So they look dark, and they took those shapes, and they see things like emus.
With these different perspectives on our night sky, I imagine there's also some different stories behind the stars.
Yes. So in the case of Chile, the animal of choice is the llama. And it's following the river of the Milky Way. So that's how it was described, which is not uncommon, actually, not uncommon in many parts of the world. And the animal, over the course of the night, eventually gets thirsty. So wants to come down to the earth to find some water. And the story goes that if it touches you, that gives you good luck. So if it happens to be close to you, then that's a good sign. So if you live that far south, are things that you cannot see from Milwaukee. And one example would be a beautiful fuzzy blob that I told my friend, look, I really want to see the Magellanic Clouds. So if I do that, then I've checked a box and I'm all set. These are two little satellite galaxies that go around the Milky Way. And again, they're not visible from our point of view, but they're there. And if you are far enough south, you get to see them. So I was able to see the Magellanic Cloud. So these are faint, fuzzy blobs in the sky. One of them is a little bigger than the other. And these are the companions to our own galaxy.
That's amazing. And there are some constellations or celestial objects that we can see and track, for example, the North Star.
True. We can track the North Star where we are. If you are deep in the tropics, then you should be able to see the North Star some of the time. But the thing you can ha hold on to just as well as we hold on to the North Star is the Southern Cross. It's described as a Southern Cross. It's on several flags of different countries, but to me in the sky it looks like a kite because there is no line that connects the stars. If you imagine in the kite that you connect the long side of it and you look to its left for two really bright stars in Centaurus, like they're really bright stars, imagine the middle part and draw a line between those two. Where the two lines meet is pointing where south is. So just like we can use the Big Dipper to find the North Star, they can use the Southern Cross and the two bright stars in Centaurus to find south.
We've been talking about a lot of fun changes in perspective. Are there any other kind of unique celestial views that we could see from the tropics?
Yes. So I've had students who come from different parts of the world and they see how the crescent moon is shown and they think, whoa, 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 that's wrong. What's that? They're used to seeing the moon as a U when it sets because the angle of the moon is different when you see it, say, from the equator. So we're used to seeing it kind of upright, right? Like a C that's, it might be a proper C or an inverted C, but it is standing up. If you are living on the equator, then the moon, when it's crescent, is going to look like a U that sets into the sky.
It's good to think about that because we get very used to the way, quote unquote, our moon looks,
That's
right?
right. That's right. Yes. We get very used to. And then other people bring that fresh perspective and that surprise, like, wait, I'm not used to the moon looking like that.
Well, I'm sure not just the change in perspective, but of course, learning new things is a welcome change of pace in a sometimes dreary spring for a trip to the tropics. So, Jean, thank you so much for joining me to share more.
Great. Thank you so much, Audrey.
Jean Creighton is our regular astronomy contributor and the director of UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium. Their show, Stars in the Tropics, runs every Friday this month. There's more information at WUWM.com. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area that you've always wondered about at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and when we come back, we'll hear some of the best new songs from local musicians with a bit of country flair. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Although it may not feel like it, spring is here and summer is fast approaching. As we get ready for our season of outside entertainment, we're checking out some of the best new songs from local musicians. Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record, and every month he creates a list of some great new songs from Milwaukee musicians. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to share a few of his top picks of the month.
So there is a light theme with this group of songs. They're all vaguely country, some more country than others. I would say that definitely applies to this first song. It comes from a longtime Milwaukee group, Collections of Colonies of Bees.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right about the theme, too. It is very loose, and it gets looser as we go along here. So let's start with a real country song from a group you wouldn't associate with country music. And yes, that is Collections of Colonies of Bees. They are a fantastic post-rock group that's been around really since like the 90s, goes back to the 90s. Chris Rosenau is kind of the lead, kind of the constant of this group, a guitar player and a fantastic musician. And this group has changed and mutated many, many times over the years. These days, they've, I think, really found a really fantastic groove with a vocalist that used to be an instrumental band. And now, for the last few years, they've had a fantastic vocalist in Marielle Allschwang, who herself is a fantastic artist, has a lot of fantastic solo albums out. And Coco Bees, as they're known, they are getting ready to put out a new record this summer. It is called Celebrities. But the song that we're going to be hearing, the kind of country song, is not from their upcoming album. It is from a kind of alternate album that they're releasing called Rhinestones, which is a three-track album of songs from their Celebrities album, but done in a country style. They kind of stumbled upon this. Apparently, Marielle, they had been working on this this record in rehearsals, and just for giggles, Marielle would kind of sing some of these songs in kind of a country twang. And she kind of just kept doing that for months and months, and at some point they were like, why don't we just kind of record these songs in a country style? So they kind of arrange them differently, put some new instrumentation on them, and lo and behold, there's a kind of a little country accompaniment album. The song we're going to be listening to is called A Tricky Lonesome Sin, and the actual song that will be released later this summer is just called A Tricky Sin, but this is the country version, and it's very fantastic. I really love this concept. Really looking forward to the new album, but in the meantime, we have this. It's the latest from Collections of Colonies of Bees. It is called A Tricky Lonesome Sin.
Don't let them down. Let them run around town. 'Cause it means a lot to be in love with them. She talks in dangers too.
A Tricky Lonesome Sin by Collections of Colonies of Bees. Now, this next song feels pretty modern country to me. Not quite pop country, but still a more modern country sound. It's from a group that I wasn't actually familiar with before this.
The group is Wire and Nail, and they've been around town now for, I don't know, 7, 8 years or so. They only have a couple of EPs to their name. And you're right, they do have a very kind of classic, very slick and modern country sound. And they just released, I guess it would be their debut LP. It is a full-length album. And I love the name of this record a lot. The name of their new record is called Rippin' Darts and Breakin' Hearts. And you just can't get more country than that. The song we're going to be listening to is the lead-off track from that record. It's called Hey Someday. And yeah, like I said, it's a very classic modern country sound. This one's maybe a little more down-tempo than the others, but I think for people who are looking for that classic kind of modern country sound, and it's not an easy thing to do, Wire and Nail does it very, very well. So this is Wire and Nail with Hey Someday.
Off and
miles of searching for the line that's gonna make things fine. I said, hey, someday, pick up the phone and say something real. Hey, someday, dig myself out of that grave I dug.
Hey, Someday by Wire and Nail. The next song we're looking at is, I would call it maybe more classic country. It has a pretty heavy twang, and the subject matter feels very classic country.
Absolutely. This is a song from Laura Peterson and the Old Souls. Laura Peterson and the Old Souls, they just put out a record recently called Separation, and it is a kind of a loose concept album about disintegrating relationships and the trouble we all have with relationships, kind of a universal theme for a lot of music, and especially for country music. And the song we're going to be listening to is actually the final track on that record. It's called Just a Little More Suffering. Throughout this record, it kind of shifts. It's not just a straight country record. There's a little bit of classic rock in there. There's some more kind of, I would say, like 90s, almost Shania Twain-esque country pop in there. And then this song, Just a Little More Suffering, is almost more bluegrass than country. It's kind of the outlier on this record. And I really like the whole record, but this one really stood out for me. So it's a fantastic new song from Laura Peterson and the Old Souls. It's called Just a Little More Suffering.
A Little More Suffering by Laura Peterson and the Old Souls. The final song we have is, I would say, maybe country adjacent.
At best.
It has a slight bluesy feel, maybe. The melancholic lyrics definitely have a country feel.
Yep, this is definitely where I'm stretching the definition of country. I suppose you could call it doom country if you want to, or kind of weird Americana. This is a new song from Milwaukee group, The Resurrectionists, or just Resurrectionists. No, the. I'm always very sensitive to that because I run a website called Milwaukee Record and not The Milwaukee Record. But anyway, this latest song from Resurrectionists, it's called Make a Place for Them. And as I was saying, Resurrectionists, a terrific band led up by a musician, his name is Joe Cannon and company, and they've been around for a number of years, again, doing this kind of very dark, weird Americana, you know, kind of gloom country, gloom folk kind of vibe. You know, for people who are big fans of, like, you know, something like Tom Waits or something, it doesn't sound like Tom Waits, but it's in that kind of world. They have a new EP out. It is called Anytime You Make a Place for Them. And this is a follow-up to a full-length album they put out a couple of years ago that was absolutely fantastic. That was called Now That We Are All Ghosts. That record from 2023 was terrific, and it had a lot of terrific videos to go along with the songs. And now they kind of just dropped this EP. The song we're going to be listening to, like I said, is called Make a Place for Them. It's a fantastic Resurrectionist track, and I should note that with this new EP, you can also buy the EP, buy the CD or a vinyl copy, and with it you get an Oracle deck inspired by the songs on this record. So very, very on brand for the Resurrectionists. So this is Resurrectionists with Make a Place for Them.
The wounds were too much. Was indifferent foe. Don't you know ghosts appear? And at time you make a place for them. Shut up!
Make a Place for Them by Resurrectionists. Well, Matt Wild, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
And at time you make a place. Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month, he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about some of the best new music from local bands. At WUWM.com, you can find all of their previous conversations. And Milwaukee Music Roundup wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.